Today, shock and awe. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to my latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian and New Zealand's perspective. And today I'm joined again by property expert Joe Wilkes. Hi Joe, long time no see.
It is, Martin, and my apologies. I've been out of action. Well, since Governor Orr decided to cut the cash rate by 0.5%, I've been digging holes in the garden trying to find somewhere to bury my money.
You've got that much to worry about it. I'm impressed.
No, but I don't want to get negative interest rates on any of it. That's the thing. So, my apologies. Obviously, you've been busy, and congratulations on Jill making it home. So, good news all round there. And I've been tied up with an engagement the last couple of weeks, which has kept me fairly occupied. So our diaries haven't allowed us to collide, but we've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, it's been a busy old time, and the old Reserve Bank in New Zealand has been quite active.
Yeah, well, they're leading the way. I don't know, when I was at university, the expression I would have used for that type of action would have been that someone's just crapped the bed, because it shocked everybody, 0.5% cut in the cash rate, and the currency markets have been wobbling up and down like nobody's business. And it's really interesting, because there's no real discussion about why they've done it. On the surface, unemployment doesn't look too bad. GDP's still ticking along. And yet you've got the cash rate cut, the government going out encouraging people to go and borrow and spend. Just going around a lot of areas that I've seen over the last couple of weeks, you can see shopping centres, there's huge discounts going on. And I know it's sort of the winter sales period, but I went into one shopping mall this week and every shop had a sale which was 50 to 60% off. So there is a major, major concern. And it hasn't been talked about in the press, but if you look at the lending data for the end of July that was published, you can see that for the first time, really, we've seen a drop off in the pace of credit growth year on year. And it's still growing. It's still growing massively. But it's been obviously looked at, reviewed. I think they have a fair understanding of what's going on the RBNZ, and every time I post one of our DFE links on LinkedIn, I do get quite a few people from Treasury, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and the various banking bodies and businesses in New Zealand coming and having a look at our stuff. So they're learning slowly, it was a really, really big call to cut it that quickly.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting. I think you can draw parallels perhaps with the US, because, of course, the Fed cut and they basically said, look, nothing to see here. It's a mild course correction. Everything else is absolutely fine. I think in New Zealand, though, the tenor of the conversation appeared to be things are looking significantly less rosy. There are some clouds on the horizon, so we want to prepare ourselves. So in a way, I think they're being a bit more honest than maybe the Fed was.
Yeah, I think so. Very much a preemptive strike. But it's really, I look at the reliance that we have on our housing market, and that's very much the thing for our credit growth, and that's where it all comes from. And Mike up in Auckland, he actually put some a data series together. So what Mike's done is he's comparing the volume of residential transactions, and he's put a series together. So you've got the 12-month comparison, so from the end of July, comparing the 12-month period. Then he looks at the six-month period and comparing the last 6 months to the corresponding 6 months of last year. Then the three-month series and then the one-month series. And it's really interesting, because transaction volumes actually did take a little bit of a fillip up in July, but it's regional transaction volumes, which are lower priced, and therefore they're not generating the same level of debt in the system that the economy needs. And it's hit three of the major centres. I haven't got the data for Tauranga, which Tauranga, Hamilton would probably be fourth and fifth in terms of the volume influence, but Wellington's catching up now. So if you look at the 12-month data series, sales volumes are minus 5.8% down on the 12-month data series, which would have ended at the end of July 2018. The 6-month data series is down minus 10.7%, so an increase in the reduction of, or the pace of reduction of transactions. The 3-month series compared to 3 months comparison of last year, minus 13.2%, and the 1-month series minus 16.6%. So this is gathering pace. The same trend is happening in Christchurch. So the 12-month data series minus 5.2%, the 6-month comparisons are minus 13.5%, the 3 months again escalating minus 18.86%, and the 1 month for, so July compared to July last year, minus 24.2% in terms of volume of sales. Pretty similar, actually, if you look at it, to what we were talking about with our Will Boris Be Blamed posts and the drop-offs that they're seeing in the UK. Now, Auckland, this is the big one because this is essentially 40% of our transaction volumes. The 12-month data series, minus 9.8% decrease in the volume of transactions compared to the same period of 2008 up to July 2018. The 6-month data series is minus 22%. The 3-month data series minus 25%, and the 1-month data series minus 26%. So again, this is sharp drop-offs. And with the rush that we saw in the end of 2018, so August, September, October, and some of those finalized sales in November to beat the foreign buyer ban, and all that cash that was flowing off on subsequent transactions, I can't see anything other than this escalating, which is why we've got to get more debt in the system, and that's why they've cut the cash rate as sharply as they have done, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no doubt that as interest rates come down, that gives a little bit more latitude in terms of lending standards. I mean, Australia, we've seen that recently with the looser settings for lending. And of course, in Australia, we're also seeing transaction volumes continuing to fall. And at the moment, there's really no indication that credit is actually turning around. It's still slowing, and we expect to see some change going forward. And it's interesting that pretty much everybody that I talk to in the political sphere here in Australia is basically saying the only lever we've got left is housing, right? Trying to bribe and bait more people to buy property, to try and borrow more, to try and sustain this economy a bit further. And I suspect that New Zealand is probably going down precisely the same path. The question, of course, is that actually, one, sustainable, and two, is it actually going to be successful?
Yeah, well, I've had some really interesting conversations the last couple of weeks, and this is from people who are in the construction sector, but also people who are wannabe first-time buyers who are coming to me and saying, look, you know, we just want to have a conversation. I have extended myself and given some time to these people just to say, look, I don't know everything. I can't say I've got a crystal ball, but what I can talk about is some of the numbers that we're seeing. And there's some really interesting things happening. I had a conversation with a director of an Auckland-based construction company who've got a couple of projects on the go, which fundamentally they won't be completed probably for another 16, 17 months. Now, he was really open. He said, well, we've had some issues where we pre-sold these units prior to construction. We've taken 10% deposits, so those deposits were paid. But over the last couple of months, and he was really open, he said, well, we've had 10% of those pre-sales decide they're not going to go ahead with the full purchase. So from our perspective, he's saying, well, they've lost the deposits, which keeps the cash flow side going. And he's been able to resell the majority of those units that had been withdrawn from, and actually be a bit flexible on the price because they've already taken 10% deposit off someone else. But he was quite interesting when he said, well, now that's the ones we know about. Are there going to be others who, as we go through the next 12 months, decide, hang on a minute, I'm not that keen? So really open discussion. I'm not going to name who he was or what that development was, because that'd be unfair. But there is a recognition that this is a challenge. I've also had some really interesting conversations with people who are thinking about buying and just what they're being told by the banks. Lady Jessica, who's a DFA watcher and has living in New Zealand, been over here for a number of years, but originally from the States. Now, Jessica, I spoke to yesterday, she's in her 50s, early 50s, reasonable income earner. She's earning six figures, but a low six-figure number. And she's looking at a house purchase on her own. And I find this quite interesting because she even questioned the sense of it, but she went to ASB, and with her income, she was offered the opportunity for a mortgage of over $700,000, so seven times her income, to which she said, well, you know, that's all well and good, but I would like to be able to pay it back by the time I'm 65. And the advice that she got from the person who was, you know, behind the counter and not really what I would call, you know, probably not a financial advisor, was, oh, don't worry about that, because by the time you are 65, it will have gone up and you'll have been able to, you know, pay some of it down and have more equity to find an alternative move. Jessica, I think, was scared at how shallow the advice was. And then the girl who's, you know, a young girl in her late 20s, she said, oh, we've just done it, me and my boyfriend. So the advice that's coming out of the banking sector is still not thinking about the longer term interests of the buyers who, you know, they are overcommitting late in life and may find challenges further down the track if this armor plated housing bubble doesn't keep itself stable. The signs are that it's not going to. Did you read the paper about the from Christian Hawksby and the unconventional monetary policy that the RBNZ are now discussing?
Yes, and it's interesting because, again, they're being a little more transparent than a number of other central bankers, aren't they?
They are. Well, it's you know, we've got to think that this was a in the event of something horrific comes up discussion that started at the RBNZ 12 months ago. And the general didn't seem to be much concerned that it would ever have to be enacted. And yet what we've got now is you know, public discussion about negative interest rates and about alternative measures and unconventional measures that the RBNZ could use. Now, this for me is a sign that their thinking is changing very, very quickly. And that thinking is different to the conversations I had back in February and March, where I spoke to a couple of people at the RBNZ and just said, well, look, I had a concern at the time about the way that the numbers of loans being written didn't seem to match up with the numbers of transactions that first-time buyers were taking. And we've subsequently got, the RBNZ they previously have asked for macroprudential regulation around debt to income measures. You know, in Auckland paper this week, over 50% of first time buyers are taking on debt to income beyond 5. They won't say, okay, is it 6, is it 7, is it 8, but it is beyond 5, and that's quite a heavy level of exposure for first time buyers. Now, the other thing that I think that's probably been not washed under the carpet, but we've got a Labour Party finance minister who is vehemently against the introduction of debt-to-income measures when he was, you know, first questioned on this a year and a half ago, or when he first came into office. And yet now he's gone very, very quiet on it. So I don't think that they want to introduce debt-to-income measures, and I'm pretty sure that even if the Reserve Bank were to get the opportunity to have it, that they won't introduce it at this stage in the cycle, because it would magnify the challenge. But it is the only thing that's keeping us going.
Yeah, what's interesting, because debt-to-income, of course, is I've always held that is a very, very critical measure, and it's interesting that in the UK, the Bank of England there has a 4.5 debt to income hurdle. You know, above, you can lend a certain amount above that, but not a whole amount above that, right? Here in Australia, we had this last week, Westpac saying that anything over 7 times, they would now not use an automated system. They'd actually have an underwriter look at it. and we know that some of the other banks are still lending at 7, 8, 9 times in our debt to income. So in a way, it's all part of the chicanery about trying to actually still allow people to borrow and get people to borrow more. And yet, it's going back to your slightly earlier point about, well, of course, the magic pudding here is that property values will continue to rise. You know, the old mantra, it doubles every 7 years. I still hear that a lot. And therefore, you can create capital and that can repay the loan later. So, of course, it's a win-win situation. But the trouble that I see, I'm not sure where that property price growth is going to come from. And if we don't see property price growth at that sort of level, people are saddled with big debts. Now, interest rates are very low, so they can still service the interest repayments on those debts, but they've still got to find a way to repay the capital. And that's the thing that I think the banks are really not very responsible about at the moment. And I notice in Australia, responsible lending has, you know, taken a bit of a step up because of the HEM decision with between ASIC and Westpac, which basically says that household expenditure measure ratios are fine. You can still use them as part of the lending standards. But there really is no conversation about how to repay the capital. And for me, that's the big question that I would have thought every lender should be having a conversation with every borrower about. And every borrower should actually have a plan to know how to deal with it. Because if they don't, then they could be in shit street later.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the UK, when, you know, the last sort of 6 or 7 years, and particularly with the structure around how much would be lent or how many people would receive lending beyond 4.5 times their household income, the other thing that was quite stringent was, you know, when are they taking on this debt? Are they taking this debt on as a 25-year-old with 40 years in the workforce, a 30-year mortgage, hopefully giving them 10 years clear? Or are they actually giving 30-year mortgages to people who are in their late 40s, early 50s? Yes, because they've got aspirations to go and buy something that maybe they couldn't afford otherwise, but they're with no strategic understanding of, okay, what happens if we then see prices, you know, could wobble, and then they may take years to recover. This is going to really create a burden on the spending that we're going to see in the rest of the economy.
Well, that's right. And it's worth underscoring again, a lender makes a decision about the loss to the bank. In other words, how likely is it that they're going to actually end up with a bad debt that they're going to have to write off? They are not making a decision based on necessarily the best interests of the consumer, nor indeed how the consumer is going to repay that loan. That's a whole different conversation. And so many people that I survey in my ongoing analysis of this situation is, well, if the bank says I can have the loan, it must be okay. That's basically where they come from, right? And I keep coming back to the fact that it's a completely different agenda. One is loss to the lender, and the other is the impact on the household and how they're going to actually dig a hole out of the debt bomb that they've got. And those two things are just not the same. And yet so often, I think households and consumers wander into these big debts without fully understanding the implications and the fact that there are these two agendas running.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, I spoke to a lot of people who were house purchasers in the UK going through all the way through the 2010s. And what you'd find is that, you know, if you were 47, 48, your borrowing ability would be capped around your income and around sensible expenses, but it would be capped also as the expectation that you would have that debt paid off by 65. Yep. So that's, I'm pretty certain that's not happening here. And I don't think that anyone is going to raise that conversation given where we are at the moment and all the other things that have already seemed to be started. Interesting times.
Yeah, well, as we said the other day, you know, people moving into retirement still with those mortgages, still having to pay it off. And, you know, as I keep saying, low interest rates help with regard to the interest payments, but you still have to pay the capital off one way or the other. So, as you say, yeah. Joe, really interesting times.
Yeah, but, you know, they've woken up to it here and they're taking some steps just to carry it on.
Yeah, and look, I guess my perspective is I think New Zealand is a little bit ahead of the curve compared with everybody else, which is kudos to them. So shock and awe. But I think we're going to hear a lot more about this ahead.
Indeed.
Thanks, Joe, for your time.
Good speaking to you, Martin.
So there you have it. Lower interest rates, negative interest rates, more Reserve Bank action. Could be an interesting time. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.